Wait, the New York Mets are offering Juan Soto how much? Yes, welcome on in to First Pitch for Tuesday, November 19th. Your source of news, notes, and updates on Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Lindsey Crosby. Follow me on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. He's Troy Brock, Troy B Baseball on the Twitter machine. And Troy, we're going to get to the awards coming out the next couple of days, manager and Cy Young. We're going to get to Baltimore changing their ballpark dimensions. We're going to get to who Juan Soto's meeting with today. We do need to start off with Rookie of the Year, though, because I think that we all kind of expected Paul Skenes to win Rookie of the Year in the National League. I mean, he was a Cy Young finalist. Kind of makes sense. He's going to win Rookie of the Year. But Luis Gil wins it in the American League. I think we both saw Colton Cowser doing this yesterday, right? We both had Colton Cowser as the winner. This was surprisingly close. They were separated by 5 total points, 15 first place votes for Luis Gil and 10 second place. Colton Cowser got 13 first place, 11 second, and 3 third place votes, which had to end up being the deciding factor here. Is this defensible for Luis Gil to have won the Rookie of the Year over Colton Cowser?
I don't think so. Like I talked about yesterday, this is it. I thought Luis Gil was going to come in second over Austin Wells just because of the popularity contest aspect of it. And it turned out to be even stronger of a case when Luis Gil won the whole thing over Colton Cowser. And I think that it 100% came down to a popularity contest because, to be completely honest, for those of us that do cover baseball on a national level, it's hard for us to keep up with everything and every player across the league and what they're doing. And so we depend on the hype and the popularity that is out there and readily available for the most part. And across the entire season, you didn't hear much about Colton Cowser. He had a fantastic season, and he, in my opinion, deserved the Rookie of the Year in the American League. But you didn't hear as much about him as you did Luis Gil. And the writers, like us, they cover baseball on a national level. So they went off of what they heard more of, and more of that was Luis Gil. So in my opinion, popularity contest got Luis Gil that award.
There you go. And some of the stats that came out yesterday in support of Luis Gil make it a little easier to stomach, I guess, him winning the award. He led the American League pitchers in opponent batting average. He was second in hits per 9 innings, fourth in strikeouts, strikeout per 9 innings at 10.15, sixth in opponent slugging, 10th in opponent OPS. But I do still agree that this was, like, it was difficult to overlook the full season dominance, not dominance, but the full season excellence of Colton Cowser for a very hot start for Luis Gil and then some struggles down the stretch. Now, I say that he did allow 3 runs or fewer in 22 of his 29 starts. It's not like he was giving up 6 and 7 runs often on the back end. He allowed 2 runs or fewer in 18 starts and 1 or 0 runs in 17 starts, which does tie with Tarik Skubal and Garrett Crochet for the most in the majors. So I do think that's relevant, but it's just one of those things where I do feel like this is kind of like the Hall of Fame argument, right? This is the peak to me. This is the peak over the longevity. Colton Cowser did it mostly all season. Luis Gil was very, very dominant early in the year. And then he ended up just being a very good pitcher. Like he wasn't bad, but he had that amazing peak. And it feels like in the Hall of Fame stuff, so many guys who I think fit into that box, like a Dale Murphy and Andrew Jones, just end up not making the Hall of Fame when they don't have that longevity. And to me, I guess I was thinking about that when I was thinking there's no way Luis Gil beats Colton Cowser for this.
No, yeah, I'm right there with you. And I don't want it to seem like I'm taking anything away from Luis Gil. I mean, he did have a very good season, but like you said, it was most of his production came in the beginning of the year. I would love to pull up the splits, but Baseball Reference has been down all morning. But I believe that yesterday morning you said that in 1 month he had an ERA above six for the month after posting an ERA in the low twos the month prior. And so it's just it was, like you said, a peak and not a consistent level of production across the whole season.
I've got it here. The month of May, he was 6-0 with a 0.70 ERA. June, he had a 6.45. August, he had a 5.25. In September, he had a 4. So it was July was fine, 3.33, but it was a lot of his full season statistics were carried by the fact he made six starts in May. And he was so exceptionally good in those six starts. Because outside of that, he was fine, but he wasn't an amazing pitcher. And he wasn't the kind of guy you would think about winning Rookie of the Year, you know, putting up a 6.45 ERA across five starts or putting up a, you know, a 4 ERA across five starts, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, to me, it boils down to he had that amazing month and then there is a lot more publicity surrounding him than Colton Cowser, who was doing it for the entire season.
Yeah. Okay. So moving on a little bit to the thing that I teased at the beginning of the show here, Hector Gomez, MLB insider, who follows me on Twitter. Great guy.
He sure does.
He relayed information from former MLB player Carlos Baerga. Weird sourcing here. That the New York Mets' initial offer to Juan Soto was $660 million. With the caveat of we don't know what is deferred, if there is deferred money in there. I know Steve Cohen doesn't love the idea of deferrals because I think part of it's just the Mets have had such high-profile deferrals in the past, the Bobby Bonilla contract and everything. But is this, like, I don't want to ask, is this already over? But where do the New York Mets, the New York Yankees have to come in to keep Juan Soto? Do they have to match this exactly? Do they have to come 20 million within 40 million? Where do they have to come in if $660 million for Juan Soto is accurate as the Mets offer?
If you break it down and look at things, I think that, yes, Soto wants to make a lot of money, and he is going to make a lot of money, but winning is a big part of what he wants also. And if you look at the two teams and break them down, the Yankees and the Mets, then just disregarding the fact that the Yankees made the World Series this year, the Yankees are still the closer team to contention moving forward, with or without Juan Soto. So I think that for the Yankees, I don't think that if they wanted to land him, I don't think they would have to match the $660 million. Maybe 620, which is, you know, less than 10%. So we're talking about $40 million off of $660 million here, which is just insane. But I think maybe 620 could land him for the Yankees if they wanted him that bad.
Yeah, which... See, and at first I was thinking something like that as well. And then when you think about the time frame of this, you think about it's a 15-year deal for 660. That's $44 million a year. If you look at, well, what is, you know, 620 comes out to just under $41.5 million a year. If you're Juan Soto, can't you say, how can you not find $2.5 million a season to match this? And I would think... I mean, obviously, that amount of money is not just life-changing, but is generationally changing. It's your entire bloodline for three generations at least never has to work again.
Right.
But I still think that it ends up having to be you probably have to come within 20 million, I'd imagine. Like 640 breaks down to just over $42.5 million a year, right? And you can say, like, hey, per year, you're making under 1.5 less with us than you're making with him. But you have the options of you can pitch different endorsement, marketing plans, whatever, to fill some of that gap. It's just something where the end of the day, that dollar amount, like $60 million less on a $660 million contract is 11%. And it's like, it feels like once you get into that double digit territory, that's where you run into the issue of trying to get somebody to say, yes, take double digit percent less to come play for us. Right. And I just think it's going to have to end up being, to me, probably 640, but it also feels like, is there anybody in baseball that is going to outbid this? Like, I don't, if that's the offer the Mets have made, 660 over 15 years, this is done. Like, there's, I don't see anybody beating $44 million a year for 15 years. Like, we talked about the, could the Yankees possibly get up there? Is there anybody who could do it?
No, I don't think so, especially without having a massive amount of deferrals. And it's believed that Juan Soto is also somebody that doesn't really want the deferrals. He wants all most of the money up front. So without the deferrals, I don't think that there is any other team that could get up there to the $660 million mark.
Yeah. And on that note, we got reporting that today, the Los Angeles Dodgers are meeting with Juan Soto, and I don't know how to feel about this. I mean, anybody is welcome to meet with Juan Soto, right? And it feels like this is probably just them doing due diligence. Like, they had over a billion dollar offseason last year. The biggest reaction that I've seen on the internet, and the internet's not real life, but the biggest reaction I've seen is this general idea that if the Dodgers are able to add Juan Soto on a $600 million contract the year after spending over $1 billion to get the top two free agents in the market, that this is somewhere between a bad thing for baseball and ruining the sport altogether. Is that overly dramatic, or is it, is there a bit of truth to the idea of if the Dodgers are just able to sign the top two free agents every single season, that is going to in some way fundamentally hurt the game of baseball with the fans?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of truth to that. And I think that if they were the team that winds up signing Soto this offseason, then they're really the next CBA, they really got to start talking about implementing a salary floor or a salary cap, one of the two, to for the salary floor to get these owners off their hands and that aren't spending money and get them to spend some more money. And if it's a salary cap, to keep teams from like the Dodgers and the Yankees and even the Phillies from spending an exorbitant amount of money each and every offseason. Because yeah, if the Dodgers were able to land Soto, then I mean, you've penciled them in for the World Series every year for the remainder of the time that they have Soto, Freeman, Ohtani, and Mookie Betts in their offense. And you don't even really have to worry about the pitching because the offense is going to outscore everybody.
Yeah. I mean, this is something, the estimation of what adding Ohtani was able to do to the Dodgers, if I remember reading this right, was they projected that he resulted in over $100 million in revenue to the team. There was a 218% increase in Japanese brands advertising at MLB stadiums in general, not just Dodgers, all over the whole thing. MLB signed up for a bunch of partnerships with Japanese companies. There's a travel agency as an official league sponsor now, and they do a Japanese travel agency, and they do tourism trips to the States to go watch Ohtani and Yamamoto and everything. And so if they're able to turn that money into signing Juan Soto, it definitely feels like there's going to be a much larger outcry. We have to do something. I think you touched on it well. You can't just add a salary cap. You have to add a salary floor as well, because while this, if Juan Soto gets to the Dodgers, that would be what a lot of people consider a problem. The overall structural bigger problem in baseball is teams not spending money at the bottom of the scale. The, you know, your your teams like the Marlins, the A's have always been in this group. The Pirates are a team that are seen to be pretty penny pinching and things like that. And so you got to do something. I don't really know what it is. Like, I don't know what those numbers come out to be. Can you make it where it automatically adjusts every year? Can you figure that out? I don't quite know, but it does feel like you're going to have to do something simply because that's just going to be, that's too much. Like, that is a lot of fans, I think, are going to agree that that is just way too much at that point. Something that's not way too much, actually, is the services of our next sponsor, Encase Cards. It's a custom card manufacturer. They take source photos of, in this case for me, it was U Sports for my kids. Their artist personalized it for my kids. They did backgrounds. They put on positions, team names, all of that stuff. They print it on high-quality cardstock. They slab it, and they ship it to you as a keepsake. It's really cool. The slab, obviously, just like you would get if you were to, you know, buy some sort of PSA-graded trading card. But it has a built-in stand. They can put it on their dresser. You can give them as gifts. Really cool thing. So check them out, NCASECards.com. That's NCASECards.com. Okay, looking at some of the awards that are left to be given out. Tonight is, I believe it's tonight, is Manager of the Year. And so when we're looking at Manager of the Year here, okay, American League, this, we might as well just rename this the AL Central Awards, right? AJ Hinch of the Tigers, Matt Quattaro of the Royals, Stephen Vogt of the Guardians. Which of these three, I think, or do you think, deserves Manager of the Year for what they did, not in the postseason, but in the regular season this year?
This one's tough because really all three did a phenomenal job with their teams this year. But in my opinion, I would give it to AJ Hinch after taking his team from below 500 at the trade deadline through a sell-off and then into the postseason, and just what they were able to do from the trade deadline to the end of the year after a sell-off is just insane. So I would give it to AJ Hinch out of those three.
Yeah, I think I'm leaning towards Matt Quattaro of the Royals simply because of the enormity of their turnaround. They lost 106 games in 2023, and yep, they go from that to a postseason team with an MVP candidate. And yes, Bobby Witt had something to do with that, but he was on the team when they lost 106 games. They, you know, the Tigers had to figure out pitching. Their rotation was depleted. The Royals had a bullpen picture that was just a nebulous cloud all season, and they somehow made it work. I do think Stephen Vogt is going to, one, he's well-respected in the game, being a former player, first-year manager, stepping in for Terry Francona, dealing with, you know, leaning on a bullpen because rotation issues just like Hinch did. But I do think people are going to maybe ding him a little bit for the better state of the team before he got there as compared to what Quattaro and Hinch are dealing with. Hinch is going to be interesting. He's finished in the top five four times, and he's never won this. So it's going to be really cool to see if he can find a way to do this. National League is actually all three divisions are represented here, right? Carlos Mendoza for the New York Mets, Pat Murphy for the Milwaukee Brewers, Mike Schilt for the San Diego Padres. Am I wrong in saying this feels like it's a Mendoza versus Murphy thing and Schilt's going to be in third place?
No, not at all. I'm right there with you. I think it is Mendoza versus Murphy. And in my opinion, I think that Mendoza will win it. Just because of the turnaround they had in the middle of the season. They might even consider giving it to Grimace. Who knows?
Yeah. And this is something where, like, nothing against Schilt, but we knew the Padres were good, right? The Padres were good. They got better this year, but we knew the Padres were good already. Mendoza took over a team that had publicly said their goal was to be in contention in 2025. Yep. Yes, they got an MVP season out of Francisco Lindor. They hit on some of these pitchers, but everything else was not, like, the offense struggled for a good portion of the year. Pete Alonso never quite looked the same before contract year, obviously. They dealt with injuries in there. I don't want to discount what Pat Murphy did. It feels like the Brewers are perpetually counted out of that top tier of teams in the National League. And I think they've shown despite everything that's going on, obviously they traded away Corbin Burns, and somehow won 93 games, cruised to a division title. Despite all of us thinking like, okay, Brandon Woodruff's out for the year, Corbin Burns is gone, they're going to struggle. No, they plugged a 20-year-old into the outfield and made it. But it does feel like Mendoza probably did more, and I would argue maybe with less than the Brewers had. Brewers fans are going to hate me for that. But I do feel like Mendoza did more with less for the Mets, because it was a bunch of journeymen on one-year deals, and it was a team that had, again, publicly said, we're not going to compete until 2025. So I think it's going to be close between those two. I wouldn't be surprised if these vote totals are rather close. And then Schiltz in third place. Hate it for you, buddy. Sorry. Want to get into real quick on quick pitch here, just some kind of other news and notes we haven't really had a chance to cover across the league. The Baltimore Orioles are bringing back in some of the dimensions of left field. When they put Baltimore in place a couple seasons ago, it was something where all of their right-handed hitters, they didn't have a ton of them, probably hated it. Their pitchers loved it. And they've kind of stocked up on left-handed hitters and a lot of left-handed hit prospects. They are now, they're not bringing it back to the original dimensions, but they're kind of cutting, splitting the difference a little bit. One, how do we feel about the Orioles changing the dimensions just 2 or 3 years later? And two, is this something that more teams should be aggressive about doing in changing their ballpark to fit the construction of their roster? Or is that just a little bit too much in the search for a competitive edge?
I think it's a little bit too much. I think that teams should be more willing to construct their roster around the park that they play in, because it's going to be a lot cheaper to pay players than it is to continuously rebuild your entire stadium year after year just because of a few players here and there. But it is interesting that they only had the giant gaping hole in left field for three seasons, and now they're bringing the wall back in. And like you said, some of their right-handed hitters, maybe they don't trade Ryan Mountcastle now. Maybe they hold on to him because he can hit a few more home runs. But it's an interesting development up there in Baltimore, and Camden Yards is a little bit more hitter-friendly for righties.
Yeah, this is something where I don't necessarily think that this needs to be a common thing that teams do on the regular, changing their ballpark around. I do think it was a bit of an overcorrection to push it out as far as they did. So I'm glad that they're kind of fixing that. I do wonder the process here, and I'm sure there'll be a story some point in time this offseason from somebody who has insider access about what kind of role MLB has in these ballpark changes, or if they do at all. Is this something you have to submit proposals to the league and they have to approve it? Can you just, as long as you meet the minimum requirements, can you go ahead and just make whatever changes you want whenever you want? I'd be curious to know how this works, because I can't imagine MLB would love the idea of teams aggressively changing their ballpark every couple seasons to fit the makeup of their roster. But I do agree with you. More teams need to be mindful of their ballpark effects when they construct a roster, or even when they make moves. I'm thinking about the Isak Paredes trade, where he went from Tampa Bay to Chicago. I know Chicago needed a third baseman. That's one of the worst ballparks for his batted ball profile in all of baseball, because he's probably the most extreme pull hitting power hitter in baseball, and the dimensions aren't that favorable to him down the left field line. I would think, if anything, Houston would have been the best fit for him, given the Crawford boxes and the short porch there. And it's something where, in retrospect, if you could pick a couple different third basemen to trade for, Paredes would not have been the guy Chicago should have gotten if they were paying attention to their ballpark, but they weren't. So I do kind of agree with you that I think we need to have a little more stuff there. Speaking of the Astros, Minute Maid Park is changing the name. It was originally Enron Field. Okay. It opened in 2000 and as Enron Field, 30-year agreement. And 2 years in, Enron filed for bankruptcy, that whole scandal. It became Minute Maid Park, which Minute Maid, you know, the juice people, They were based in Houston as a subsidiary of Coca-Cola. At the time, they then owner, I think it was Drayton McLean at that time, said that they were taking over the remaining term, so 28 years. The team announced yesterday that Daikin Comfort Technologies, which is an air conditioning company that has a facility there in the Houston metro area, based in Japan, by the way, point we made earlier on the show,
yep.
They are taking over as the new naming sponsor. We don't have, I think, financial terms released yet, but Minute Maid's going to remain a partner of the team, but not the name, not name for the stadium. Thoughts on Daikin Park? I think it's Daikin. I couldn't be saying that wrong. I think it's Daikin Park. Thoughts on the name of Daikin Park?
I like your pronunciation a little bit better than what I thought it was, but they
Daikin Park.
Yeah.
When you have to ask what the correct pronunciation is, maybe that's a problem with your name.
Absolutely. Nobody has to ask what Minute Maid Park is or Citizens Bank Park or Truist Park. But anyway, as I've said multiple times, my wife is from Houston. We've been to many, many games at Minute Maid Park. And right. the Houston fans called it the Juice Box because Minute Maid is juice. And so now it's going to be interesting to go to the Ice Box. It's also going to be interesting.
The Ice Box. That's a really good name. I like that.
That's a little bit better than trying to figure out how to pronounce the actual name. But yeah. It's going to be interesting because they have a train up on the thing in left field, and it's got it's just carrying a bunch of fake oranges. And every time a player hits a home run, the train goes back and forth, and there's a guy up there, which if Minute Maid Park is still going to be a part of them, then they may keep that. But it happens. They probably got paid a lot of money for it, and that'll be good for them in the long run for their free agency hopes. But it's just going to be hard to get used to calling it the Ice Box instead of the Juice Box.
Hey, the Ice Box is a much better name than Daikin Park. I wonder, did they have to change all the air conditioning units in the ballpark for this? Like, did Daikin give them new AC units as part of the whole thing? I wonder if that's it. The last thing here, it broke over the weekend, and we just didn't have a chance to get it in yesterday's show. The Topps is doing the rookie debut patch program. I don't know if people have seen this. The patch that the players wear, the MLB debut patch, they have taken those game-worn patches and made one-of-one cards for several MLB players. Paul Skenes, newly minted Rookie of the Year, is one of those. The packs released last, I think the 13th, and the Pirates want the card. The mm-hmm. Pittsburgh Pirates want the card. So they have offered a package, and they said, here is what the person who gets that card will get if they give the card to us. They will get two Pirates season tickets behind home plate for the next 30 years. They will get a softball game for 30 at the park with coaching provided by Pirates alumni, and a trip to spring training where you will get a private tour of Lecom Park and Pirate City, which Lecom Park is a beautiful park. I did some spring training things down there a couple years ago. Mai Tai stand out left field. It's a beautiful ballpark. While you're there, you'll get a meet and greet with Paul Skenes. You'll get two autographed jerseys from him. You'll get to take batting practice and defensive drills with the team, and then, quote, and other unique experiences. Now, in response to that tweet, a guy who runs an auction house said, call me instead, because we will sell this card for you, and you will pay for your kids to go to college, and you will make millions of dollars. And then Libby Dunn, the girlfriend of Paul Skenes, said, I'll up the ante. This is in response to the Pirates offer, and said, we will, you'll get to watch a game, a Paul Skenes start from my suite with me. If you were to pull this card, Troy, are you taking the Pirates offer or are you auctioning this card off?
I would probably take the Pirates offer, even though Paul Skenes is a very highly touted player, and you would get I don't think you'd get like Shohei Ohtani home run ball money for this one card. I would take the Pirates offer, especially because I'd get to sit in a suite with Livy Dunn for an entire baseball game. I mean, that's enough for me. The Pirates can keep all the other stuff. Just let me hang out with Livy Dunn for a couple hours.
Flip side, you could probably donate enough money to charity where she'd give you that too. And like, here's the thing. Okay, if I was a Pirates fan, if I lived in Pittsburgh, I think I'd probably take the Pirates offer, right? You would be, assuming those seats are decent seats. I don't even think they're like, they're probably not right behind home plate, like first row, but they're probably like in the lower section. If they're in the lower section behind home plate, great. If I lived in Pittsburgh, yes, let me do this offer. Let me get these things. I would be known to the organization. Fans would know me and like me and all of that good stuff. And this is my kid's entire childhood plus some, we'd have season tickets. That'd be great. Me, Lindsey Crosby, who does not live in Pittsburgh, I don't know how useful a lot of that stuff is to me. Like, yes, great. The spring training trip. Okay. You can probably pay for a tour of the ballpark. The softball game, you can probably pay for the chance to do a softball game. There's a bunch of NFL teams were doing fantasy football draft parties from the stadium. Like, I'm sure you can pay for the softball game. The jersey and the meet and greet, you can probably pay for those things. And if I don't live there, how useful are the season tickets to me? And I think I think the odds are a non-Pirates fan is going to pull this. So I'm probably going with the auction as well. I have no reason when it's worth that much money, it's not worth it to keep it. If it was like maybe worth a couple grand, I might just keep it because it's just cool to have. But if it's worth, let's say it's worth $500,000, that money's more valuable to me than the season tickets to a city I don't live in, right? So it's always tough. Let us know what you would do. Leave it in the comments down below. You can tweet at us. He's on Twitter at Troy B Baseball. I'm on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. Let us know what you would do. Throw it in our Discord too. Let us know what you would do if you pulled the one of one Paul Skeens card. Until next time, this has been First Pitch.